to invite a member of our group to come up here and introduce our speaker tonight. And I think y'all know her. Her name is Randy. You'd rather look at her than look at me. So. Keep coming, Randy.
Okay.
You're looking good. Come on this
left. Okay.
Yeah, you're looking good.
Thank you. Thanks, Vince. My name is Randy. I am an alcoholic. Everybody in my home group is this here group with three legacies. Before I announce the speaker, first of all, I'd like to ask everyone to make sure your cell phones are off before the speaker segment of the banquet. So make sure, dig in your purses or whatever, make sure your cell phones are turned off. Also, I'd like to make a few acknowledgments each year before I introduce the speaker and special thanks. That's one of the things that we sometimes forget to do is to really thank our servants and the people that that help. And it takes a lot of people to pull something like this off. And so I want to, you know, send out some special acknowledgments. I'm not going to say any particular names because I got in trouble for that last year. But I do, you know who you are. And I want to say a special thank you to the officers in our group of the steering committee, and also the Three Legacies members that come month after month to our business meetings, and especially in the last 5 or 6 months, which is how long it takes to plan something like this. And the people that put the food out, the girls that work in the kitchen, the guys that were here today, I got here at 2 for setup and it was already done. You know, that's the kind of group we have. That's the type of enthusiasm I'm talking about. And somebody who even washed tablecloths and ironed them and everything at home. You know, it's just the kind of love and service that has to be acknowledged and has to be, you know, we just have to say thank you. So how about a big round of applause for Three Legacies for this party? If you're not a member of this group, we thank you with all of our hearts for coming and joining us. We've been trying to get y'all to do this for a long time, for all our sister groups to come, and what a great turnout. We are absolutely thrilled. And before I announce the speaker, I have another special acknowledgement that's a little bit unusual, but I feel the opportunity to make this acknowledgement, and so I'm going to go for it since I have the opportunity. Our speaker tonight, Mary P., brought her husband with her, Chet. And some people may remember this, may not, but about 4 years ago, this group was floundering. And we had some dissension, we had some disgruntled members, we had some resentments, we had some disorganization, and we were really, I think, basically looking for direction, kind of a direction to take. And we decided to have a group inventory, which we'd never done, and no one in the area had ever done. And so one of our members got Chet to come out and do an inventory, group inventory. So that made us feel pretty puffed up, you know, that we had Chet P. come out. And I was like, well, your group might have had an inventory, but did you get Chet P. to come out and do your... So, because we had no idea how to do it. And Chet came out on a Monday night at 9 o'clock. That's when we have our business meetings. All the way from the other side of town where he lives. And came out to a little bitty group that meets in a trailer, probably didn't know most of us. And he helped us. He took us through a group inventory and helped us to get to the bottom of what we needed to do. And we never sent him a card or flowers, a thank you, anything. And 4 years later, I'm kind of happy that he can be here tonight to see how this group is flourishing. That we really have taken on a direction. And it's thriving in a way I've never seen the group thrive. So how can we not thank Chet for helping us with that? You know, that was and his wife is the speaker tonight, and as a couple, I guess that Mary and Chet P. are the type of AA members that those of us insiders would call AA superstars, and they would probably hate that. You know, they probably do not want us to call them that. But I just mean that they're the type of people that have an AA program and they live an AA program that is so much more active than anything that we could really understand or comprehend. That they're on the go all the time. They're traveling all over the country and wherever, God only knows where, to carry the message in their own special way. And it's a type of dedication and type of service that is kind of a superstar thing to me. It's like I want to be like them when I grow up kind of thing. And when I called Mary, I asked my sponsor about this year. You know, I'm looking for a good speaker for the banquet, and she said, "Well, why don't you call Mary?" So I did, but I did so with trepidation because I was a little nervous, and you know, I thought, well, I was going to say, "Well, would you come out and speak at our little anniversary and our little group out in Winter Garden?" And I called her, and she was so lovely, and she looked at her calendar and immediately said yes. And that's the kind of AA people I'm talking about here. You know, that's the kind of service, that's the kind of people that we're dealing with. And she made me feel so good. And again, I feel very, very special, you know, to have someone like Mary come and be our speaker. It makes me puffed up a little bit. I know I shouldn't be, but I'm very excited. So how about our three legacies welcome for Mary P.
Alrighty. My name's Mary Parker. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is November 27th, 1981. My home group is the College Park Triangle in Orlando, Florida. Yay, College Park Triangle. Randy, that was such a lovely introduction. I wish I didn't have to speak, because then you're going to find out about me and it's over. And there are about six or seven women in the room. It's too late anyway, so they know the deal. And they're sitting there going, "Who's she talking about?" It's okay. I want to thank Harold for the lovely email and Pam O. Pam O and I got sober around the, well, not, she's been sober longer than I have. I think we were 7 and 9 years old and we got sober right then. Something like that. But just to clarify, right, no, I better tell the truth. Actually, I'll be 67 in December. I like to give my age. I used to give my weight when I got nervous. I'm not that crazy anymore. A little more self-control than I used to have. But I was born in Columbus, Ohio. Woohoo. Yeah, well, okay, what do you hear? And my father was a World War II veteran. My mother was a housewife. And I was a much wanted and much loved child. And for a long time, I thought that disqualified me from membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I was always looking for why I was the way I was. And the answer is, it doesn't matter. I'm an alcoholic. That's the way it is. But when I was born, my parents really celebrated me. They hadn't had any girls in the family in several generations. And my father did not like Ohio because it was cold. And he was in the trucking business, and he just didn't like the kind of business that he had to do when it was snowing outside. And he had this great idea that we would all move to Florida. And this isn't like the moving company comes and gets you or anything. This is like pack up the U-Haul and move, you know, with the U-Haul behind the car and three kids in the car. My parents had two more children, my brothers. I never understood that. I still have trouble sometimes. I think I was enough. I always thought I was enough. But I was this little kid. I was really smart and really anxious and really ambitious. And that is such a weirdo combination. You know, I would go to school and cry all the way to school, afraid I'm going to be late. I'm not late anymore, am I, girls? No, I'm not. You know, but I used to be just frightened all the time. And yet when I got to school, I would be angry if anybody was better than I was. And there was this girl named Joyce English, and I wish I didn't remember her name. It's so embarrassing. This is first grade, and she was a better reader than I was. She wasn't better. She just had more expression. And I prayed to God that he'd get her out of there, because she was ruining my reputation as the best reader. And he did. And so from that point on, I knew that that was a wonderful thing, that if I prayed, maybe things would be taken care of my way. And that really worked for me at 6 years old. So we get to Florida, and it's beautiful, and the sun is shining. And you know, it really, Miami in the 50s was a lovely place to live. And I grew up in North Miami, and a lot of the kids were just super, super smart. We'd all been kind of pulled out of classes, people that were good at math and science, and I was okay, but these kids were just brilliant and sort of pushed ahead. And so it came time to go to college, and a lot of my friends had families that could really support that, and I was sort of from a middle class, is putting it nicely. We're kind of hanging on to the lower edge of middle class, and for me to go to college, just, you know, just there wasn't any money. But I was a really, really, really good test taker. So I took a lot of tests, and I got a full scholarship to a fine Southern Baptist university not too far away up the road, 1792. And I was going to college. And it was kind of amazing, and my family was really excited. I'd had a drink, no drinking, a lot of anxiety, a lot of craziness. I had a boyfriend, but I thought, you know how the boys used to roll cigarettes up in their sleeves? Some of you don't, but trust me, they used to do that. Well, I thought that had something to do with getting pregnant. So I didn't smoke, I didn't drink, I didn't do that other thing, whatever it was, which I didn't know yet. And so I was a good girl. I was a good girl not by choice, but by ignorance. And so I go up to this fine Southern Baptist school in DeLand, and I have a roommate assigned to me. They didn't let us pick our roommate. You just got what you got. And she was from Alexandria, Virginia, and she had long, dark hair and a halter top on and these Daisy Dukes with everything sticking out and a cigarette hanging out of her mouth, and she's strumming a guitar. And I'm like, why isn't that me? Why am I me in the little villager dress like this, and she's like that, and it's just not fair? And, you know. So I had a job once I got to college. Besides making straight A's, my job was to hold up her beautiful long hair after she crawled in the fire escape because she was going to be throwing up any minute now. Because she was out at parties and drinking, and I just thought it was the coolest thing. But I was... I did. I was really attracted to you before I even knew I was one. But I would get kicked out of this Baptist school if I drank. And there was no negotiation. That's the way it was. If she did, she wasn't on scholarship. But for me, there was no second chance. This is it. This is my life. So one day, at the end of the first year, I had to go home to Miami. And we were really not very well off financially, as I said. So I posted a thing to get a ride home. And this boy offered to take me home with several other people. And he had the first GTO on campus, four on the floor. Oh, what a car. I mean, it was just, the status of that car. Now, I'm not super shallow, but I was not unmindful of how cool it was to be dating a guy with this car. And so he took me home, and he took a liking to me. I don't know how I felt about him. You know, those kind of emotions just were not, I was not speaking emotional language. But he liked me, and he liked me more, and we began to date exclusively, and I kept being a good girl. Still not drinking. And I met his parents, and it was decided, and it's just about like this. It was decided we would get married, that was the right thing to do. And I have gone through all of this with no conscious thought of what does this mean? Lifetime commitment, what? So his parents say, let's go on vacation. You go on vacation with us so we can get to know you better. And my parents, I'm like, my dad is so not going to go for this. I mean, really? But these people were, they're like really, really rich. I mean, big time money. I mean, whoa, you know. And I had never been exposed to that. And they were used to getting their own way. And they got their own way with my dad, too. And so away we went on their yacht. Big yacht. After the maid stocked it with the food to go to the Bahamas. And so I'm chugging across the Devil's Triangle on my way to the Bahamas thinking, what? Now what is going to happen to me? It was just like my life was a movie and they'd cast the wrong girl in the lead role. So we get to Nassau and we walk down Bay Street, if you've ever been there, and we go by this club, and we're going into this club. It was like a bar, but it was a club. They did this floor show. The name of it was Dirty Dicks. I had the ashtray. I had the ashtray for years. Years. I couldn't make anything up like that. And so his mother said, would you like a drink? I'm like, oh no, I'm not that kind of girl. You know, and she said, honey, we're in the Bahamas. It's legal. Oh, legal. Okay, legal's good. So I have a Tom Collins with a little umbrella. I didn't know what it was, but Mom ordered it. You know, she said, oh, you'll like this. This one of those little fruity weird drinks with the orange and the cherry and the umbrella. And, you know, it was so traumatic. I've never dated a man named Tom or been married to one. That's how bad this gets. So after I have my six Tom Collins, it was hot. I was thirsty, okay? So they keep them coming. And I have a really good vocabulary, and I read extensively, I still do, and some of it was four-letter words I'd never had a chance to use before in my life. So, it seemed to me time to take this young man's inventory, which I did. In Anglo-Saxon terms, it was awful. I called him all kinds of things and pointed out inadequacies that should never be said in front of your mother, and then I threw up. And they carried me back to the yacht. And I'm thinking, this is not good. This is not good. My parents cannot afford to get me back. I mean, nobody has any money to fly me back. And we don't have a yacht in my family. And so I wake up the next morning and I'm crying and I'm apologizing. You know, I'm so sorry. You know the deal, how we do that. And his mother, we had this little family meeting, and his mother changed my life that morning. She looked at me as I'm sobbing and apologizing, and she said, "Honey, that wasn't you talking. That was the alcohol." Yeah, was it me? And I rode that one for a long time. So of course, after that noble beginning, we get married. We get married before our junior year so that we don't do anything we shouldn't do, whatever, you know. And so I'm married to this guy that I hardly know, who's from a family that I don't comprehend their lifestyle at all. And we moved to Miami to this penthouse condo in Biscayne Bay after we graduate. And here's how it goes. We went to a lot of social events, all of which were beyond any experience that I'd ever had. So before you go, what you do, if you're ever in this situation, you fill a water glass with scotch, drink it straight down, quick, gulp, and then go to the event. So one day my husband caught me with my scotch. You know, it was like medicine. You just have to do it. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm having a drink." He said, "Why? We're going to a party. We're going to be drinking." "I know, but I have to drink before I get to the party. Why?" You know. And I tried to explain that, what if you get there and they don't have what you want? What if you get there and there's not enough? What if you can't get two or three at a time? You know, what if I have to walk in stone cold sober and see them and feel the inadequacy and the fear and the pain? What if? I can't do that. So you go to the party, and then just for a little excitement, I would hit on the most attractive, unavailable man in the room, preferably somebody's boyfriend or husband. I would really make a jerk out of myself. My husband would get angry, the wife would get angry, we'd fight, we'd cry, we'd go home, and the next morning he's standing over me like this, and I'm saying I'm sorry on the phone to some poor woman who was in the bad fortune of being in a party with me. I had amends down the first part before I ever got here. I just didn't know you weren't supposed to keep doing it, you know. So after about 3 years of that, I was bored, restless, irritable, and discontent, and so I told him, "I'm leaving. I don't want your money." I was so young. No one was like, "Whoa." Somebody would get a job. I got a job, and that was fun. I got a job with a big Fortune 500 company based in Cincinnati, and I flew all over the country doing marketing for them. And so you get on a plane about 6 minutes before takeoff, because there was no security back then, and I was allowed to fly first class if I got on and the coach was sold. So sometimes I get off in San Diego and sometimes Los Angeles, because they look alike, you know. They have palm trees, it's alike. So I would do that, but I could stop it and start it. I was still at that point in my life where I could kind of go and come back. My drinking wasn't over the line all the way yet. So when I'm in Cincinnati one weekend, I go up to Columbus, Ohio, which is where I'm from, and I meet a boy. Last one was rich, this one's pretty. And I'm thinking, pretty might work. And he's an artist. And the first thing he says to me is, "You just need to know, I'm never getting married." I love a challenge. I love it. 6 months later, we're married, of course. Because that was going to be the way I wanted it. And so we did that. And I sold the giant diamond ring that I'd gotten the first time around and told him we had to go see the great art of Europe, so we're backpacking around Europe. I went to a lot of countries, some I remember, some I don't. I drank a lot of wine. I got hooked on this Retsina wine in Greece. It just tastes horrible, but by the third bottle, you don't care. And my husband he wasn't paying attention to my drinking that much. It was sort of like, it's what you do. I learned to ski backwards, falling down the Matterhorn. I really had one of those lives out of a really bad Lifetime movie. And I got to Barcelona, and I was carrying a 40-pound pack on my back. I was in such great shape. Oh my God, I'd give anything to have that again. And I get to Barcelona, and my jeans won't close, you know? What's up with this? I'm in great shape. I'm pregnant. Oops, you know. I thought I couldn't get pregnant. I think it was the cigarettes and the boys in high school and something. I missed something. So we go back to Columbus, Ohio, and I have this baby. She was beautiful and wonderful, and I was stuck in hell. I hate Ohio. Not anymore, but back then I hated it, and I was angry that I had to be there. I was going to go to the West Coast and look up Gracie Slick or something. I had plans. I had plans, and I wasn't going to get to live my plan. So I'm taking care of a baby. I have no help. I have no family. I have no anything. And I'm drinking a little bit more. Drinking becomes a little bit more important. Just a little. Not a whole lot, but I needed a drink. I needed to drink daily, but I wasn't getting drunk every day. So that sort of was like that. And I told my husband that either he would get me back to Florida or I would leave him. Poor guy. He moved me to Florida. He had his shot and he didn't take it. So here we are in Lakeland, Florida, in a duplex. And I'm drinking and drinking and trying to take care of a two-year-old and losing, quietly going out of my mind. I was just losing my mind. And I knew there was something wrong, but I wasn't sure quite what was wrong. So I thought, I'll get a job. Jobs always help, right? And I clean up great, and I can get a job. I could still get a job. Jobs are easy. Relationships are impossible. Jobs are easy. So I get a job as the assistant director of the Polk County Bicentennial Committee. And we're doing this traveling show, this stage show for the Bicentennial. This is 1976. For those of you who are born after that, just you can sleep for a minute. Anyway, so we're doing this show, and the star of the show is like 6'4", and he's an actor, and he's Uncle Sam in the show. And I'm thinking, next? You know, because if I just found the right guy, guys in parentheses, girl, it would all be okay. If I just found him, it would be okay. It wasn't my fault, you know, and so I connected with Uncle Sam in a very spiritual way. And I explained to my husband that it was over, and we were moving on, and at the end of the bicentennial show in Lakeland, which was in the middle of 1976, he got a contract, and this show went on the road, and so I became a carny. And we traveled around the country with state fairs and carnivals and lived in what my daughter called the truck house. I thought it was a motorhome, but it wasn't. It was like a truck with a cab open, you know. And she loved it, clowns and cotton candy. And my parents are at home going, so what is that cum laude degree for that you got, that economics degree? What is going on with you, you know? And I'm like, I'm just experiencing life, you know. And really the road was a great place because you can drink every day. You know, you get your money every day, you move on to the next place every day, you lose a few roadies, you pick them up, and it was my life. I mean, I loved it. I was just on the road. My ex-husband, the father of my daughter, was not so impressed, and he flew to Detroit and met me and took our daughter home with him to Lakeland, afraid something would happen. But I was just oblivious. I thought, this is a good way to live. But like all good things, the bicentennial comes to an end, and we go to Orlando, because my brother lives in Orlando. And I was looking for help, and we lived in a little trailer park. It's on Edgewater Drive. Every time I drive by there, it gives me some humility to remember this sad, sordid little trailer park. No offense to people who live there, but I had just absolutely destroyed my life, almost. I still have my daughter. And my husband couldn't find a job since he was an actor, and Uncle Sam wasn't in big demand after 1976. So I got a job. My skills, put on my navy blue suit, perked up that personality, and away I went, and I got a job as the director of a parent education program at college. Yes, I did. I was in charge of how people parented their children. I did. I was. And so there we go. That's what I was doing, and it was just a crazy life. But what had kept me from drinking so much is we were really on the downside of poor. This was a not-for-profit agency, so you don't make much money. But then one of the board members came to me one day and said, look, Mary, you know, you're in the wrong job. I'm like, yeah, I am. He said, why don't you come work for me? I'm like, okay, what do you do? He said, I sell drugs. No. He was the regional manager for a pharmaceutical company. And little did I know, there's nothing like money to ratchet your drinking up quite a bit. So I get this job for a very good company, and my job is to take doctors out to dinner with wine and alcohol. And then I go up to the home office where I'm one of the trainers, so the bar is in my room. This is in the late 70s, early 80s, and it was just crazy. It was just crazy. I had all kinds of little sordid experiences, blacking out in weird places, but I somehow on the job, I could like hold it together. And I was just The marriage wasn't working. My husband went to work for the sheriff's department. That wasn't working for me at all. And my daughter is getting older, and I don't know. I got married on February 29th to Uncle Sam, thinking like I'd only have an anniversary every 4 years, so it might last longer. Didn't work. Did not work. I really did. I got married at the Central Florida Fair, but that's a whole other story. So bad. Sometimes I love to tell this story, and sometimes I just want to hide behind the podium. So anyway, one night I decide that I'm going to have a business meeting, because I am a pharmaceutical sales rep, at the Saints and Sinners Lounge in Altamont Springs on 436. You may not have been there. It's a very fine place to have a business meeting. And I'm a drink thrower. When guys tick me off, I throw drinks at them. They do that sometimes, you know? They just get irritating, and you just kind of have to toss one at them. And this guy irritated me in my business meeting. I threw a drink at him. He threw one back, and they threw us out of the Saints and Sinners Lounge. So I get in my car, and 436, if you take a right turn from the north side of the street, you'll head for Apopka. If you take a left, if you go the other way, you'll end up going toward Orlando. Well, I went toward Apopka, and I was lost. I did not know where I was. I did not know what I was doing. And I had put my daughter in daycare. There was an evening daycare that she went to. It was called Kids World back in the day, but they closed at 11 o'clock at night. And I had just enough time to get home and pick her up. So I turn the wrong direction. I get to Apopka. I don't know where I am. I do not know where I am. So I see a light, and I pull the car over, and I pop the trunk, and I put my pantyhose and my purse in the trunk. I'll never know. I don't know. It just seemed like the right thing to do. And I hid in the bushes, waiting to be rescued. And so, this Dodge Daytona pulls up about 10 or 15 minutes later, you know, the darkened windows and all that, and this guy with sunglasses pops open the door. Hey, babe, get in. Okay. It's my rescuer, right? And I had a moment where I thought, you know, he might be planning to kill and assault me, so perhaps this wasn't a good idea. So he closes the door, and I start screaming hysterically. And he's afraid of me, I think, by this time. So he pushes me out of the car at the 7-Eleven, which in those days was open from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m., unlike now. And I sat on the bread racks and cried all night until the clerk came at 6:30 in the morning and gave me enough money to make a phone call. Well, in the meantime, the police have called my husband, who's working the night shift. My daughter has not been picked up. The whole family is just in complete turmoil, and I was devastated. And you know what's really interesting about that night? I've heard a lot of women talk about losing their kids and having all kinds of experiences, and for me it was just a matter of degree, because when I drank, and today if I drank, it's not about forgetting to pick. I didn't forget to pick her up at daycare. That's not what happened. I forgot I was a mother. I forgot I had a child. Nothing mattered. Nothing mattered but me getting what I wanted. Nothing. She was not there in my mind, which is frightening to me even today to think about. So I made a list of the things I wanted to have happen. I now believe it was my first prayer, even though at that time God and I were not on speaking terms. I wrote, I want to be a good wife. I don't know how. Three strikes and I'm almost out of this one. I want to be a good mother. We know how that was going. And I want to stop drinking for 30 days. That is the first time I ever mentioned alcohol as if it might be a problem. 30 days. I might as well have written 30 years. I had no idea how to do that. So everybody's mad at me. And of course, by 24 hours later, I just need a little drink and we're off to the races again. And I go up to my husband's office, and there's a guy there. And he's a salesman, and my husband's busy, and he says, hey, would you like to have a drink? You know, that's like falling in love words for me. And so he takes me down to his car, and he pops the trunk, and he's got ice and call brands in his trunk. And I have met the love of my life right there. Because if you want to ratchet your drinking into the fifth dimension, find somebody who drinks like you do. Well, we were meant for each other. We drank and we drank. I decided this marriage was over too. Told my daughter, you know, we're moving on. This isn't happening. And she was devastated. I didn't care. I had to have what I had to have. And finally, on that fateful day, my my wonderful boyfriend now and I, we're living together. He's married, forgive me, ladies, he's married to an Al-Anon. And she is not interested in giving him a divorce, and I am not happy. So he and I go up to Jacksonville to celebrate my brother's 30th birthday. I'll never forget my brother's 30th birthday. And we go to a club, and we're going to have a good time. And, of course, we're both very drunk. And the drink throwing starts, and the anger starts, and hysterics start. And so he walks out. He leaves. Men do not walk out on me. I always walk out first. It's a rule. Always. Not happening. So I'm going to go out, and I'm going to explain to him the error of his ways in front of everybody. I'm mad. I have no courage sober, but drinking, I was a lion. I was just... So I walk out the door, and Lion got her claws clipped. Here's a off-duty Duval County policeman ducking his head into a Crown Victoria with his hands behind his back, and I'm thinking, oh no, this isn't good. So I went up to the policeman, and in my best drunk, intelligent girl voice said, I think you're making a mistake. You know, I'm trying to explain why this shouldn't happen. He said, shut up, little lady, or you're next. I'm like, okay. Okay. So my sister-in-law and I go all over town trying to find ATMs to get enough bail money to get him out of jail. So we get to the Duval County Jail, one of my favorite places, and we're there to bail him out, and they won't bail him out because he won't speak English. Can't book him. They can't book him. I can't bail him out. Well, he's an Irish Catholic boy from Chicago. I have no idea what language he was speaking. But he thought the CIA had captured him, he told me later. So, this is the kind of man that was my soulmate, okay? Good job, Mary. Good job. So finally he comes to, and that's good. And we drive back to Orlando, and we're talking, and I said, we have got to do something. He said, oh God, yes, we've got to do something. And I said, you know, I love therapists. You go to them, you whine, you pay them money, you leave. You go back next week, you say the same thing. It's awesome. So I knew some therapist was going to take pity on me. And so I was going to call a therapist. And he said, you know, my dad had a problem with alcohol. And he went to Alcoholics Anonymous. What do you think about that? I'm like, whoa, no, oh my gosh, don't go crazy here. One bad night out of the 500 bad nights. So let's not get ridiculous. But he was pretty sure that AA was a good way to go. And I was quite sure it wasn't. And I really appreciate groups like the Three Legacies group, because my first meeting was also in a church-based meeting. And he was going to go to the Azalea Park group on the east side of town. I thought this over, and I realized that if I allowed him, to go to this meeting by himself, that one of you alcoholic sluts would grab my property, and there I'd be, alone again. I have that catch-release thing, you know, you don't let go of one, you got another one. So anyway, how did I know they were sluts? I intuitively knew. I were one. So anyway, we go to this meeting, and I go in disguise, I decide. I put on a man's pair of baggy jeans. I put on a man's shirt, a flannel shirt. I had buttoning issues. I was really shaken bad because I detoxed on my own. So I'm like this, so it wouldn't quite button. And I had giant sunglasses and a baseball cap backwards. And I felt I was overdressed, actually, for Alcoholics Anonymous. So we walk in the door. And all these people, like you, like nice-looking people, and I'm really kind of appalled. And so we sit down, and this woman walks up to me. Her name's Diane. She started a meeting called From the Heart in South Orlando, just a wonderful lady. And she walked up and said, hi, are you new? And I'm like, God, how did she know? Yeah. Perfect disguise here. So I paid attention, and when it came around to me, I imagine it was a first-step meeting, but you know, I don't know. I was so upset. And what I said was, my name's Mary, and I've always wondered what a drunk looked like, and I guess she looks a lot like me. And I started to cry. I cried for the next 5 years at least. And what I will tell you, though, is I wasn't happy to be there. I felt at home, and I didn't want to be at home. I was like, no, I'm 34 years old, and I'm cute, and well-employed, and I have money and a car and a backyard with a swimming pool, and I'm not an alcoholic. This cannot be happening. You mean I'm never going to go to a good party again as long as I live? This is horrible. So I went to one meeting a week, every Wednesday. And one night I said in the meeting, about 6 weeks in, you know, Wednesdays are the best days of the week for me. And some old-timer yells at me, you went to more meetings, you'd have more good days. So my bottom in sobriety, not everybody has to do this, but I did. My bottom in sobriety was when we went to a meeting down by the old Navy base near the airport. This girl, Jeannie, just annoyed the heck out of me. She was from Tennessee, and I love this accent now, but I'd listen to it and go, she thinks she's all that. You know. Well, she called and said, why don't you come to the Tuesday night meeting? And I was like, you think I need another one of those meetings? Really? So I go. My boyfriend and I go. And it's not going well. The divorce isn't happening. His wife has some sanity, and I want this over with. I mean, I need to be, I can't be unmarried like months at a time. That's just too much. Too stressful for me. So he tells his tale of woe about not being able to get divorced to the chairperson, and the chairperson says, very logically, keep coming back. It'll get better. And he picks up his chair, and he throws it at the chairman of the meeting. And I saw that guy not long ago, and I said, am I imagining this? He said, oh, you mean the time you threw the chair at me? I'm like, yeah, that's it. And I'm humiliated. I'm humiliated. I'm going to get thrown out of the loser's club. This is as bad as it gets. Really. I just know. They're not going to let us back in. We're done. The end. I'm finished. So I cry my way through the meeting, as usual. And at the end, I said, that's enough. I'm going to go home. I'm going to get my purse. Remember, you know, the credit card thing, all that. I'd left it all at home, amazingly. Grace of God. So we go home, and I'm there to get my purse to go drinking. I've had it. Enough is enough. And all of a sudden, there's a knock on the door. It's the girl, Jeannie, and her great big boyfriend. And he takes my boyfriend in one room, and she takes me in the other, and she says to me, Mary, you're going to have to find a God or you're going to die. And I said to her, Jeannie, I'm really sorry, but I don't believe that stuff. And she said, I didn't ask you what you believed. I just told you what to do. And sponsorship was born. And she became my sponsor. And she had me praying every morning to a God I didn't believe in and praying every night. And I just did what she said. I think I knew somewhere deep down that there was nothing left, that I was not one of those people that was going to come in and out of AA. This was a shot, and it was my only shot, and I knew it. So one night, it was a Friday night, I started getting what I call the roller coaster effect, which still scares me to think about it. I used to get these moods where I'd start feeling this feeling, and you knew you were going down. And the only solution is you drink heavily or you kill yourself. Because I could not stand to feel that shame and remorse and self-loathing. The four horsemen, they're all there on that roller coaster. And I didn't know what to do, but she had told me to call. And so I thought, okay, I'll call her. And remember, no pagers, no cell phones, very few answering machines. It was a dark time, let me tell you. You guys don't know how lucky you are. So I call her, she's not there, nobody answers. So I have our little group list. I call the next person. I call the next person. Nobody's there. Well, they're all at the Friday night meeting. I mean, you know, dummy. But she had told me that there would come a time where there was no effective mental defense against the first drink. That defense must come from a higher power. So I got on my knees and I said my first prayer, my real prayer in AA, which was, God, which I blank and don't believe is there, but if you're there, help me. And he did. Right then, right there, I felt a peace that I can't even describe to you today. I had never felt peace since I was a small child. And just for a moment, I was at peace. And I was blown away. So I called Jeannie the next day, and I said, Jeannie, there's a God. We knew that, Mary. And she started me through the steps. And it was wonderful. She really helped me see my part in things. And when she listened to my fifth step, she did something so loving. I have done this with every woman I've ever done this with, and for the first time. She held my hands and she prayed, which I thought was kind of creepy, but okay. And then she said, I want to tell you the worst thing I've ever done. And she did. And I hadn't done it. So disappointed. You know, I'm very competitive, bad and good. And so I had to tell her the stuff I forgot to write down because she needed to know. So I was one of those little AA zealots going to all these meetings and going to detox and having people throw up in my car, and, you know, and that should be the end of the story and it's happily ever after, but it's not. I decided I should marry the bad boyfriend because it was God's will. God got us sober on the same day, and God had personally told me that he wanted us married. I personally heard it from God. She sounds a lot like me, but never mind. And my sponsor said, she said, "You are not ready. Do not do that. You are not ready." And I ignored sponsor direction, and I married the guy, and for a little bit it was okay, and then I began to live in hell. He was not okay. He had a lot of problems, and Alcoholics Anonymous was not for him after a few years, and this is my story, not his, but just suffice to say, things did not go well. And what went worst was I had sponsorship light, and that is not their fault, that's mine. I did not share what was going on. I sat in meetings and talked about God. God and I are one. I'm on the broad highway. I could quote the big book like nobody's business, but I never told anybody how bad it was getting at my house. So I'm living this secret life, smiling in AA, and I never was out of AA. I was always involved in service. Lying does not improve your program, I just have to tell you. So I got to a point where my daughter was almost grown up, and she was going to college, and I knew I had to get back into my old field just to have enough money to get a divorce. I knew it was over. I just couldn't live like that anymore. And I remember getting on my knees and saying, "God, make me the woman you want me to be, no matter what, no matter what the cost. Just take what you have, just take it. I can't do this anymore." And I got a job with another big pharmaceutical company, and I flew up to Philadelphia, and where there I was training, and I got on the bus there, and by now I'm in my middle 40s. I was 34 when I started, and I'm leaning up against the window, and it's February, and it's cold, and I'm thinking, I can't do this again. I can't do this again. And but I did. And I called AA, because I was well-trained, and I'm 10 years sober by this time, and I've been going downhill every year, and nobody knows. Not drinking, just miserable. And so I called this AA club, and I said, "Hi, I really need a meeting." And they said, "Laura," you know, they weren't real friendly. I thought, ew. So they didn't call me back, and I called them back, and I said, "Hey, you know, I called you early." And the guy said, "Listen, Azita, I told you I'd get back to you." I'm like, "Azita, what is he talking about? He doesn't even know my name." So the next day I go into this meeting, and it's a meeting of trainers, and it's a pretty elite group from around the country. There were only 8 of us, and we all have little brass nameplates, and I've cried myself to sleep, and now I have my suit on and my white frilly blouse, and sitting directly across from me is Azita D. from Los Angeles, California. I'm like, huh. So at the break, I walk up to her and I say, "I'm so cool. Have you ever met Dr. Bob or Bill W.?" And she starts screaming, oh my God, my sponsor said you'd be here. She said you'd be here. I'm like, who's your sponsor? She gives me some name I have never heard in my life. And I said, "I don't know her." She said, no, I'm 6 months sober, and I knew if I had to come here, I would drink. And she told me to pray, and God would send somebody to save me. Well, I don't know who saved who, but I will tell you, we just tore up Pennsylvania. We went to meetings all over the place, this tall, gorgeous Iranian girl and me, and studied the big book, and I came home, and I knew what I have to do, and I ended that marriage, and there's one more little thing that I have to tell you. Hi, God. I finished my fourth marriage, but right at the end of that, I had this friend that I'd met the day he got sober, and he was adorable, but my girlfriend and I knew he was a loser and would never stay sober, so we tried just to be nice to him, and he became my best friend, and we hung out together. No hanky-panky, just friends. But we'd never been sober at the same, we'd never been single at the same time, and so when I found myself single and he found himself single, I was separated, not divorced. He said to me, "Look, we've been having lunch for years and having these conversations for years, and, you know, why don't we just get married and skip the dating thing?" Well, I am a girl that's never heard a proposal that she said no to. So I said, "Sure, let's get married." This was Chet. You know, it was so perfect. He's a divorce attorney. You know, how much better could a girl like him do? So we decide to get married, but first I have to get legally divorced. So we go to the courthouse, and this friend of his walks me through the divorce, and I wear my brown divorce dress. It's really a depressing dress, but if you're me, you need a dress like that. And I come out in this brown, ugly dress, and he says, you know, I've only got 30 minutes till my next client, and I'm a lawyer, I can get all the paperwork. Why don't we just get married right now? I'm like, okay. So we go up and into a courtroom, which also felt right, and no flowers, no rings, no guests, just us and Kimberly, the clerk, and Chet and me, and I'm married. Ta-da! And he goes back to his office, and I go to Leesburg to do a hospital in-service. But that night, we're going to meet at Roma's, this nice little restaurant in Apopka. So I finish my in-service, and I'm still wearing the brown divorce dress, and we go to Roma's, the restaurant, and he's there waiting for me, all smiles, and I'm like, oh, this is so romantic. And he introduces me to the lady who owns the restaurant. Her name, they called her Mama. She's a little Italian lady, so adorable. And he said, Mama, this is my wife, Mary. And she goes, oh, that is so sweet. He brings all his wives here the first night. So, want to do an inventory, honey? No, anyway. I survived that one. It's the truth, too, he does. But it's about structure. If you know Chet, it's all about structure. It's nothing to do. So we survived that, and his children lived with us, and I never had boys before. That was quite an experience. And I knew I had to do something with my life. You know, I couldn't just sit around and do nothing. So I went back to school, and I became that person that I used to make fun of. I became a therapist, and I work with families and with individuals, and I'm really, really hard to put over anything on. And I don't work with alcoholics, and the reason is because I've got their number when they walk in the door. But sometimes one or two of them will crawl under the door, and generally speaking, I send them to you because I know that you'll do a better job than I could ever do with them. It's been quite a ride. Alcoholics Anonymous gives us sobriety, but it doesn't give us everything we want. It just gives us what we need. And I always thought I'd get everything I wanted and I'd be blissfully happy. And I think sometimes newcomers hear that and it's kind of scary. We ended up, 6 years ago, Chet was diagnosed with cancer and lost his voice, which for an attorney is not a good thing, and it took quite a while for that to come back. And last summer I had what I call my adventures in breast cancer, which was really fortunate. I felt so lucky because I'm the person that is just absolutely manic about healthcare, and had I not been that kind of manic person, it wouldn't have been discovered when it was, and I wouldn't be healthy today, and I am. And I'm very fortunate. But all those things I've gone through, I've gone through with people from Alcoholics Anonymous, all of them. There's nothing that has happened, good or bad, that I've had to do alone. You know, I went through becoming a mother of teenage boys. I went through a child who was, you know, an alcoholic who had to get sober, and people from Alcoholics Anonymous helped us with that. I didn't have to be in the world without resources. And there's really nothing that can happen that isn't part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Right now I talk about having breast cancer, and I don't mean it's not a big deal, but I have a sponsee who has a young son who's 2 years old that was diagnosed with neuroblastoma, which is a particularly horrible form of childhood cancer, and he's stage 4, which is not good, and he's just going through hell. His name is Cannon. Keep him in your prayers. But that girl was in New York, and one of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous who used to live in Orlando was up there and stayed in touch with her and went to the hospital with her, and she made meetings. This girl made meetings. All my other sponsees are not going to like her, because whenever they decide, I'm really too busy to go to a meeting, I'm like, yeah, well, what about, you know, and then they don't get to say that anymore. Because if you're serious about this program, you know, no matter what happens in your life, you've got to be sober. I have a daughter who's 40 years old. She was the 8-year-old that I got sober with. And I remember thinking when her son was born, I was there, I spent the night, he spent a little time in the NICU, and he's healthy today, he's 11 years old today. And there was something that night that happened that just sort of amazed me. I realized that all those things I had hoped for, I was 20 years sober when he was born. I had wanted to be a good wife. I am a good wife. A faithful, good wife for the last 21 years. Who knew it was even possible? God knows I tried enough. You know, I was a good mother. And I really am a good mother. I'm a great grandmother. Wonderful grandmother. Teaching my granddaughter to drive. I mean, how good is that? You know. And I've been sober a lot longer than 30 days. And I didn't do that. I didn't do that by myself. I did that through the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, through meetings like this. I love these kinds of meetings where people have an investment in each other. And it's not just that day, but it's all week long. We know about each other. We care about each other. And I just want you to know that a crazy, whacked out, can't possibly stay in one place girl like me can get sober. Anybody can do it. Thank you for my sobriety. Thank you for my life.